WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latte from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Well, it may be President's Day, but it's the Vice President's who are in the headlines. This is the official music, in case you never heard it, for the Vice President of the United States. Whenever you think of that, you think of Joe Biden, right? Or maybe Dick Cheney or Al Gore. Well, here is the current Vice President on television yesterday talking about the previous one.
That's Dick Cheney. I mean, thank God the last administration didn't listen to him at the end. But then I also heard that he got into saying he disagreed with the last administration, with the last attorney general, Republican attorney general. So I think his fight seems to be with the last administration. We did exactly what President Bush did. We got the similar result. We are protecting America. And I don't know. It seems like Dick Cheney can't take yes for an answer.
Well, Vice President Biden with Bob Schieffer on CBS Face the Nation yesterday. The dueling Veep interviews, just one symptom of the extreme partisan divide in national politics right now. And our first guest today is National Journal political analyst Ron Brownstein, political director at Atlantic Media. Hi, Ron. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning. Glad to be back.
So politically speaking, did anyone win the Battle of the Veeps yesterday?
First of all, who knew there was vice presidential dedicated music?
Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Covering Washington for how long?
I would say off and on 25 years.
You learn by listening to the Brian Lehrer Show.
I think you do. I don't think either side. Clearly won. It is an ongoing fight that shows no sign of letting up. Unlike, I suppose, every other argument we're having in Washington, which is proceeding toward stalemate one after the other. But I do think that it's fascinating the line of argument that Joe Biden used there at the end. You can imagine how that's being received at, say, Move On or the Daily Kos or the Huffington Post when he basically said, "Look, we're just doing what they did." And in fact, I think, in fairness, I mean, what President Obama has tried to do on the broad range, I think, of anti-terror policies is to he has not completely repudiated what Bush has done by any means, but wherever possible, and this is where I think he's running into resistance. Wherever possible, he has tried to steer the policy in the direction of leaning more on the traditional way of doing things, more conventional channels, more conventional policies, which he believes will be more acceptable to the rest of the world and also as effective. So, start off, close Guantanamo, move them to a maximum security, a supermax prison in the U.S., not abandon the military commission, but as in the case of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, try cases in civilian court where possible. And you've got this ferocious resistance from Republicans, even though, as Biden correctly said, certainly by the end, the Bush administration was moving in the same direction on many of those questions as well.
And I guess the biggest news from those appearances yesterday was probably Biden confirming that they are reconsidering a military trial for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the other 9/11 suspects. So again, politically, and we've had many guests to argue right or wrong of that over time. In fact, we'll have the former Manhattan DA, Robert Morgenthau, to do some of that later in the program. But politically, what do you think happens if they do withdraw the civilian trials? Are they seen as incompetent or are they seen as open and flexible?
Well, I mean, they are facing poor public opinion on that question. By and large, the public has been skeptical of the civilian trial approach, even though, as Jane Mayer points out in The New Yorker, overwhelmingly the approach that the Bush administration took for the vast majority of cases regarding terror suspects. I think it will be seen as blood in the water. I think it would clearly be, as in the delay on Guantanamo, it would clearly be something that was done not because they believed it was the best thing to do, but because they believed they had no choice politically but to move in that direction. So I think it would clearly be seen as encouraging further attacks from the Republicans. But of course, the situation they're in, as they are on many issues, is after Massachusetts and New Jersey and Virginia, a lot of the Democrats from more swing places or red-leaning states are getting nervous about a lot of things.
And did you hear how Biden put it? If they do go back on the civilian trials, he said it would be because they were forced to by the Republican Congress that might not release funding for the civilian trials. He said our preference is civilian trials, but they control the purse strings.
Well, and of course, there are 41 Republicans in the Senate, and the Democrats have a nearly 80-seat majority in the House. So you would need plenty of Democratic agreement for that to happen. And it is a sign, as I said, that of the nervousness among, understandable on many fronts, of Democrats from swing districts about the way this overall policy has been pursued. I think you know, the Obama people can make a strong case, and when you look at the facts, that they are continuing in many ways down tracks that the Bush administration moved toward in their second term, even while trying to adjust it somewhat further. But they are not winning that argument, clearly, in Washington and judging by the polls to the public at large.
Ron Brownstein from Atlantic Media and the National Journal. And here's another clip of Biden on Meet the Press. And you talk about how some Democrats may go along with the 41 Republicans on a policy like that. But his target this time is not Dick Cheney, but Republicans in the Senate and their propensity to use the filibuster.
Right.
Most people would agree that the United States Senate has never acted as consistently as they have to require a supermajority, that is 60 votes, to get anything done. That's a fundamental shift. I was there for 36 years. I don't ever recall it being abused and used as much as it has now.
So there's, again, Biden on Meet the Press. Do you know, historically,
yes,
how unusual this last year has been in terms?
Yes, he's absolutely right. I mean, there were more cloture votes in the Senate last year than there were in the decade of the 1960s. And it is now, I think, accepted in Washington that virtually everything, you know, anything more controversial than naming a post office is going to require 60 votes. This is more routine, routinized use of the filibuster than ever, although we have been moving in this direction. I mean, certainly from the 80s to the 90s, there was an enormous increase under Bill Clinton in the 90s with the Republican Congress. It continued to grow somewhat in the early part of this decade. There was another big upsurge in 2007-2008 after Democrats gained control. Republican senators used the filibuster widely. And then this year. But, you know, Brian, there are two things happening at once. At the same time, we are seeing more and more use of the filibuster. We are also seeing less and less of senators crossing party lines to create bipartisan coalitions. The level of party line voting in the Senate is at the highest it's been since the turn of the 20th century. So essentially, in some ways, we are moving toward what amounts to a parliamentary system in which each side stands together against the other on virtually every major issue. But because of the use of the filibuster, it's a parliamentary system without majority rule. And that is a model that is not followed by any other country in the world because it simply doesn't work. If you need 60 votes to do everything and no one from the minority party will vote with you on almost anything, you know, governing in that circumstance is pretty difficult. The last time before this year either party had 60 Senate seats was the first 2 years of the Carter administration. So the idea that you're going to be able to function as a country when you require 60 votes for everything and there is no crossing of party lines to build these majorities, you're going to look at a lot of stalemate for in most circumstances.
And on the other side, because of that, we have the Democrats considering using the process known as reconciliation, which is exactly not to reconcile anything with the Republicans, but rather to get something like the health care bill through Congress. It's a process used for budget measures that can bypass the filibuster and get passed with only 51 votes. Do you know historically how that has been used? Because Democrats are saying, oh, this is not the nuclear option, so-called. This is something that has been used, for example, by Republicans during the Reagan years for politically contentious legislation. Do you know the history of that?
Yeah, well, sure. I mean, the reconciliation was created in the Budget Act of 74 as a way of reconciling the budget-related matters, and it certainly has been used. I mean, George Bush passed his tax cuts in 2003 through reconciliation. I believe it was a 50-50 tie vote, as I recall, with Vice President Cheney casting the tie-breaking vote. For the kinds of things they are talking about using it for on health care, I think it would be certainly within the framework and the parameters of what reconciliation has been used for in the past. And just so the readers or listeners are clear, I mean, the idea that is being discussed and probably is the only realistic way, if they are going to pass health care, would be for the Senate and the House to simultaneously or sequentially pass changes to the Senate bill through the reconciliation process, which could pass the Senate with 50 votes plus Vice President Biden. And then the House would pass that reconciliation bill plus the underlying Senate bill, so the Senate would never have to vote again on its underlying bill. That may be the only way, if they are going to pass health care, that they can get there.
What do you think will happen with that proposed healthcare televised summit with the president and Congress? Will it happen a week from Thursday as planned? Will it be businesslike or really just partisan posturing on all sides? Any thought about that?
Well, you know, I don't know exactly how it's going to play out. My guess is that it's mostly partisan posturing. I think that the president, if he's smart, will be looking for ways to conspicuously adopt some Republican ideas and to say, or I should say that the plan already, the plan as passed by both chambers, particularly in the Senate, does incorporate some Republican ideas. I think he will try to go further in that direction. I think Republicans are going to be very leery of moving too far in a direction toward cooperation because they believe that what they're doing is working, right? I mean, from a purely political point of view, the president's approval rating is coming down. The Republican position in the generic ballot tests are moving up. And, of course, you have the results in Massachusetts and New Jersey and Virginia. Tremendous improvement in Republican recruiting for Congress in the last few months. So they feel that this posture of total opposition is working, as it did for them in 93-94 under Bill Clinton. So I think they have very little incentive to really try to make a deal. And as I said, it's getting harder and harder for presidents to peel off three or four or five senators from the other party to work with them. I mean, let's not forget that when George Bush wanted to do fundamental restructuring of Social Security in 2005, his staff firmly believed that some of those red state Democratic senators would have to work with him to introduce these private accounts and to kind of fundamentally reshape Social Security. None did. It's exactly what's happening to Obama. There's kind of a structural change in our politics here. We're as I say, evolving towards something that's much closer to a parliamentary style. Yeah. System, and yet the rules of the game don't really allow for that if you're requiring 60 votes to do everything.
Of course, the privatization of Social Security was so unpopular that it didn't get through, even though Bush had a Republican Congress in 2005. A lot of Republicans peeled off from that one, too, right?
Right, right. They were unwilling to do it on their own, in particular. I mean, I think it was it's popular among Republicans, but it was not popular with the public. And as you say, I mean, the Republicans did have a majority, but they were not comfortable trying to force it through on their own. But look, I mean, you know, the overall health care plan is polling somewhat better than Social Security reform did in 2005, but not vastly better, depending on the poll. I mean, the Post had it pretty close to a split, but the bottom line is that the plan is facing resistance from the public in the same way, maybe not to quite the same extent, but is comparable. It's not a majority proposition at this point, and Democrats would have to do this on their own. That's just a very tough way to run the country. If you ask one party to be the only ones to walk the plank on big things really aren't going to happen very often, I think.
And then we get to the definition of bipartisan. You talked about how Obama and the Democrats might try to include some Republican proposals, but someone wrote that the two parties right now on both jobs bills and health care bills have different definitions of bipartisan. Democrats think it means Democratic bills that include a few Republican items. Republicans think it means only bills that both parties agree on fully.
Right, right, and that is a definition that, you know, never really has been applied. I mean, what Obama, I think, said last week, President Obama, a week ago Tuesday, when he was in the White House press room, I think it was Tuesday, you know, he said, look, I think instead of either or solutions, we need both and solutions. That's his vision of bipartisanship. For example, on energy and climate change, he's saying, yeah, let's do the carbon emission limits that I want, but I will accept as part of that promotion of nuclear power and onshore and offshore drilling that Republicans want. On health care, I mean, his case, I think, is pretty plausible. That, you know, if you look at the bill that the Senate passed, Brian, with it's centered around a mandate on individuals to buy insurance, coupled with fundamental insurance reform, paid for by slowing the growth of Medicare, that is fundamentally the John Chafee, Bob Dole alternative to Hillary Clinton's plan in 1993. And, of course, that is also fundamentally what Mitt Romney passed in Massachusetts. He was the one who exhumed the idea of the individual right. mandate, where it had disappeared for 12 years. And it's also what Bob Dole, Howard Baker, and Tom Daschle released last summer.
But the Republicans are saying no to that.
And they're saying no. They're saying no en masse to that, you know. And it's not that the Senate bill is some wild-eyed, you know, kind of radical restructuring of the healthcare system. But I think that what I thought you were going to say in framing the question was, in many ways, the parties don't even agree on the definition of the problem.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the Republican proposals on healthcare, the alternatives do virtually nothing to expand coverage to the uninsured. That they do not really accept that as a problem that, quote, has to be solved. And, you know, if you don't. If you're starting from different premises, same thing on climate change, you know, and even on the deficit of the debt. I mean, they say the problem is the government spends and taxes too much, not really the level of the debt. So they're starting from different premises, and we're not seeing a willingness in Washington. And, you know, we talked about this when my book came out a couple years ago, the Second Civil War. We're not seeing a willingness to kind of accept the reality that you know, this is a diverse country with diverse viewpoints, and ultimately the job of politicians is to find a way to harmonize those. Everyone is digging in and kind of playing more to their own side than the other. And I would say of the two, the Republicans are being much more intransigent at this point.
You'll have to update the next Civil War for the 2010 elections.
Yeah.
A lot of that definitely applies. And I got to go, but you have an article on National Journal right now called The Four Quadrants of Congress.
Yes.
And the theory is that race and education levels determine who wins congressional districts. So the more minorities there are, the more educated whites there are, the more likely a Democrat is to win, which is, I think, the classic coalition. Educated whites and minorities vote for Democrats. How does that model explain Scott Brown?
Right. Well, in Massachusetts, it was clearly, you know, a little-known fact in the best two polls that were done after the election. Martha Coakley, the Democrat, obviously won minority voters. She won college-educated whites. She held on to them, but she lost non-college whites, working-class white voters. He got about 65% of that vote in both of the best polls that were done after the election. The short point of the story is that the same coalition, as you say, we're seeing in the modern presidential coalition, a kind of upstairs-downstairs coalition for Democrats of better-educated, socially liberal whites and minority voters with working-class white voters who used to be the anchor of the Democratic coalition in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, now being the anchor of the Republican coalition. That's what we see at presidential level. Certainly it was true in Obama-McCain. And what my story shows is how that is filtering down into Congress and that there is a clear demographic pattern to the kind of seats that each party holds. The seats that are predominantly white and the whites are predominantly non-college, that's where Republicans are strongest. Those seats are shrinking as a share of the total, but they're still the single largest group in Congress, and that is where the Democrats face the maximum vulnerability in this election. I mean, whether you're Blanche Lincoln in Arkansas or some of these House members, they could face substantial losses in those places because blue-collar whites have really were skeptical of Obama to begin with, and they've hardened in their opposition.
Ron Brownstein, political director at Atlantic Media and columnist for National Journal. Let's keep talking during this election year, okay?
Thanks much, Brian.
Thank you very much. Brian Lehrer, WNYC, and we'll have a related conversation next with a guest from New York, a guest from New Jersey, on the question of do we need to rethink the basic social contract between taxpayers and public employees in a time of big state deficits. Stay with us.